Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. The genre of the fantastic, science fiction, horror, and fantasy have long been one of the best outlets for metaphor. Because the rules of reality in genre films are as flexible as a pocket watch painted by Salvador Dali, lots of social commentary has been cloaked by creative storytelling. You are able to fill in your own thoughts about racism in George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, the Vietnam War in Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, communism and the Cold War and paranoia in both Don Siegel's and Phil Kaufman's versions of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But sometimes a film will step out from behind the screen of metaphor and blatantly put forward its social and political issues for all the world to see. One such film is RoboCop, a scathing and hilarious and bloody and horrifying satire of Reagan-era fear and loathing, the right-wing privatization of law enforcement through military strength and profit. It is a canny send-up of media and money and the powerful crushing the people under the weight of its profits. Though it was produced under the shadow of Blade Runner and The Terminator, no one had seen anything like RoboCop before. Its intelligent political satire was a genre high watermark, and the list of the talents who contributed to its excellence is remarkable. There's a new documentary series chronicling the creation of this amazing movie called RoboDoc, The Creation of RoboCop, streaming now on Screambox. So now is a great time to pay tribute to this masterpiece of science fiction satire. Joining us to tell us about its history are co-writer Michael Miner and visual effects artist Phil Tippett. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me here to talk about something pretty momentous.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, Phil. I think the last time we saw each other was at that UCLA screening in 2017, something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I had a beard, and I went up to give Paul a hug, and he thought I was going to attack him. He didn't recognize me.
You've spent a lot more time around Ed than myself, but I do want to say I'm a huge fan. Those little tiny bolts on the back of Ed 209's legs are, I will say, frigging incredible. I mean, the details, the things that you did were masterful.
Well, I wish I could take credit for that, but that was the model was done by Craig Hayes Design.
Well, there are a bunch of terrific people involved in this, not least of which being Rob Bottin and yourself, Phil, and Michael. You co-wrote the script with Ed Neumeier, who conceived of it. Now, Michael, you came out of UCLA and you have a master's of arts degree, right?
Yeah, I was film school. A lot of people slag on film school, especially its current form, but it really did give me contacts, people who still read my stuff, who I was with back in 19, 80 through 84. I learned how to operate a camera and learned a lot there, least of which was writing, which I sort of really learned on RoboCop. Ironically, Phil and the maestros who John Davison brought in were the real veterans of filmmaking. And Ed and I mean, it was our first, I had written two other scripts, but it was our first sale and our first, we were the rookies. So that's kind of ironic.
And Ed was a studio executive before he was a screenwriter, right? So
it's funny how we met, you know, make a left turn, make a right turn. He saw a package of short films and mine was one of them. And I mean, I would take any meeting in the world at that time trying to build my career. And I met Ed and he had already worked out a first act for RoboCop. And when he pitched it to me at lunch, I said to the waiter, I'll have what he's having. And so we then wrote the spec script between October and December of 1984. And it pretty much stayed the way it was. It just got better and better. We were very, very, very fortunate.
So it began as a social satire as much as a genre film, right?
Yeah. And Ed had a insight into some corporate stuff. I was sort of the hippie in the woodpile. I think Phil can relate to this. I protested the Vietnam War. I'm 8 years older than Ed. So a lot of the satire involved in the end of the Reagan era, in the media breaks and in the snide dialogue, I can claim at least partial credit for.
So yeah, we went to a bunch of protests back in the day when I was in college, and we would have little knapsacks and backpacks that we put bricks in it because we were in San Diego next to Camp Pendleton.
Wow, I went to San Diego State and was protesting the Vietnam War at the same time.
Yeah, so we bought you know, the sheriff's department was pretty much, you know, DIs from Camp Pendleton.
Right.
And they weren't very funny. And, you know, we get show up for an Angela Davis, you know, speech, and it was like scary.
Yeah, it was a.
How old are you, if I could ask Phil? How old are you?
Am I now?
Yeah,
71.
So was that UCSD or San Diego State?
I was going to a junior college in San Diego.
Palomar. Oh, I went to Grossmont College. Which one did you go to?
Palomar.
Oh, okay. So you were in North County.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting how those movements, the anti-war movement, equal rights amendment and civil rights amendments all became part, originally they were protests, they were rebellions, and they became part of the main culture. It's a remarkable thing that happened.
Yeah, I've been watching, going through the entire inventory of Alex Gibney's documentaries.
Oh yeah,
you know, and just recently, and God, all of the, you know, details that I didn't know about. I just knew what was on, you know, the news of, you know, Reagan and, you know, Nixon, and just going through all of it, all of Gibney's stuff is pretty much about the hubris of people that rise to the top and believe that they're omnipotent, you know.
Oh, we're not familiar with that today.
Well, it's where, as Foucault says, it's tyranny versus rebellion.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because ours was the first generation that did not follow in the footsteps of our parents. We believed that there was another way to live, and a way where people came first rather than occupation.
Very true.
But
thank God.
Yes. And I don't know, we're struggling with that today as we did 40 years ago, but 40 and 50 years ago. But what's great about RoboCop is that it incorporates all that without hiding behind metaphor. You know, it's all up front. And it's really funny. And, you know, there's some exaggeration there, but not that much. For people who remember the Reagan era, it was a pretty nasty time as well, which we seem to be reflecting on these days, right at this time. So could there be a RoboCop from today that expresses the same sort of anger and rebellion?
I think it would be more surreal.
Yes.
Well, you are a surrealist, Phil. Your movie Mad God is full of anger and the machine against humanity.
Well, it's not surrealist at all. You know, surrealists are about these juxtaposition, the wild juxtaposition. Mad God was pretty much a normal movie, you know. It had a through line and, you know, I mean,
it has a story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything's contiguous, you know, so it didn't have like cut to the moon and then cut to a razor blade cutting an eyeball.
Right. Right. It's not.
Phil's right. Surrealism has an element of satire in it, like the fur lined toilet seat, two things that are in the frame that don't belong there.
Right.
And I think that jarring quality has a satirical element, edge to it.
Right.
What would a RoboCop be like today, Mike, if you and Ed were to put together something that aimed at the same targets? Are they the same targets or have those targets moved?
I think they are the same targets, probably grown more tyrannical and scary, which includes the panopticon and surveillance and globalization, artificial intelligence, all meant to keep the general public corralled. I think that what's interesting about imprisonment and law enforcement is that now everyone's behavior is being looked at. And we all are aware that we live in glass houses, and some of us don't care. But if you get caught in the wrong stream, you can at least get canceled. And there's a form of punishment in that. And that didn't exist when we wrote the original RoboCop. So there are a number of other tyrannical gestures and fences and walls. And I think that the incarceration of minorities ethnic minorities and racial minorities has grown much more severe based on overpopulation, blah, blah, blah.
And there have been people who have made it okay to show your racism.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the more things change, the more they get worse.
Can I quote you on that?
Yeah.
There's your T-shirt, Phil. Yeah. But Phil, you started at a very early age with Crater Lake Monster. You created the puppets for that, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I started doing commercials in LA, you know, and then, you know, I worked my mentors, you know, were working on their own.
Like Poppin' Fresh and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, so, you know, one of my mentors, Dave Allen, asked me to make Crater Lake Monster, you know, for another one of my mentors, Bill Stromberg. And that was, yeah, one of the very first, you know, movies, you know, that I worked on. It was terrible.
Yeah, well, Dave Allen and you and Jim Upperly and the like were very influenced by the great Ray Bradbury. Can you tell me when you first experienced and got excited by the idea of stop motion animation creatures?
In 1955, 56, I was about 5 years old, and somebody had King Kong on the television, and the TV sets back then were really tiny, and I recall watching it from behind a chair, and then that sent me on this huge quest, you know, dinosaurs. And so I studied dinosaurs for years and years and years. And then in 1958, Ray Harryhausen's Seventh Voyage of Sinbad came on. And I was struck by a bolt of lightning at that time. Haven't, you know, been the same since.
That film has been so influential to so many film, not just special effects artists, but filmmakers themselves.
Oh.
It seems to have been particularly of this generation. it launched a lot of film careers, it seems.
Yeah, well, it was magic. You know, and one of the things that Ray was very careful with was to protect his magic, you know, and not let anybody know exactly how he did it. Unlike today, where you can pick up, it's printed on the front page of the newspaper about how everything's done, you know, which kind of destroys the magic.
Yeah, well, in addition to stop motion, there was go motion, which was a refinement. Can you tell me a little about how that worked?
Well, as the, you know, Ray, you know, lower budget movies turned into the, you know, bigger, you know, A budget movies, it really required something, you know, to scale everything up by a notch. And I was visiting Dennis Muren and Ken Ralston. They were on the night crew on the first Star Wars. And that's when I was introduced to motion control. It was the first time I saw that. And animators, stop motion guys have been attempting to do motion blurs, previously, but none of them look that great.
Well, the just so the audience understands, in stop motion, of course, each shot is a posed figure. It's done one frame at a time, and each frame you move the figure a little bit to simulate actual motion, to create motion on film. But because it's so stopped for each frame, it's lacking the movement that a normal person or thing on a screen that makes a movement would have, a bit of a blur. And so this was the idea of adding some blur to an inanimate object to make it seem more animate.
Yeah, and we first thing when we moved up north, just a sec. Yeah, I'm doing an interview now. I'll call you back. Where were we?
Well, we are talking about the creation of Go Motion.
Oh, yeah. So the first thing we did when we moved up to San Anselmo, or San Rafael, was Ken Ralston and I hooked up. I had a puppet left over from Joe Dante and John Davison's Piranha. It was a little fish thing.
Oh, yeah.
And we hooked that up, and we just had one axis at the time. And we spent, you know, part of an afternoon shooting some tests and, you know, at different exposures and you know, lengths of time, and ran the dailies. And that was that, you know. And from there, we just went on and developed more sophisticated, go motion techniques for what.
How did you blur the frame to create that sensation of motion?
Oh, it was a pain in the ass. You know, I mean, I totally had to rethink how I thought about pantomime and performance, because, you know, with stop motion, you're essentially sculpting in time, you know, and with Go Motion, there's all the XYZ servo motors and rods that are going there. And so it was more like building up tracks, like musical tracks, where you would just do the forward momentum and run it back, and then you'd lift the leg up and run that forward, and then run it back, and then and set the leg down and run it back, and da 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 for each thing. And at that time, we were using the same system that they used to fly the spaceships. And so it was what they called on a velocity stick. You had like this little controller that would let the thing run. But I had no idea where I was in time. And so we had an assistant that would, you know, the computer at that time was a Mac that was like that big. And it would count out pulses on the stepper motors. And there was an assistant that we equivocated those to frames. So she would call out 6, 12, 18, 24. So I knew where I was temporally.
But what a tedious process.
Yeah, it was. And it was, I would say, you know, between 80 and 90% was using the Go Motion technique, and then supplemented by, hands-on traditional stop motion.
So, Mike,
I remember in the theater for Empire Strikes Back when the elephant tanks came on, it blew everybody's mind. I mean, even the 3-year-olds.
What was it?
The big walkers.
Yeah, the big walkers.
Oh, that was Empire.
Yeah.
And those were all done traditional stop motion. You know, kind of like Ed 209, because the mechanical things really kind of lend themselves to that feeling.
Rather
than flesh and blood, it's metal and wood and steel. And so you don't really need that fleshy texture, right?
Well, and you just buy it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it just, I mean, so that was more Harryhausen than Go Motion.
Yeah.
Right.
So Michael, during the writing of this, how much thought went into how are we going to do this? Or was your mind completely free to be storytellers? Or was there practical considerations? Because people don't realize it, but RoboCop was a very low-budget studio movie for Orion. And we'll talk about that and John Davison and what he brought to the party.
That's a really good question. I had no thought, apologies to Phil and everyone else. I wasn't thinking about the technical and production aspects at all. And I think Ed, in many ways, wasn't either. We were just having fun. Those 3 months in late 1984, we were telling the story. And then in the rewrites with Orion, with John Davison, and then Paul, it became a little more real, the consequences of what we had written. But at the beginning, really good question. We were just trying to tell a story,
which seems to be the best way to write a movie. And then let it be somebody else's problem.
Right. I mean, like now, yeah. I mean, now that we're not rookies, and studios start yelling, we're more conscious of that, but we still, it's exactly right. You want to let your imagination run as free as possible. And of course, I remember Ed and I had a meeting with the director at, I can't remember the name of the studio. Now, they bought a building on Sunset Boulevard, and that was the beginning of the end for them. Was it
Columbia?
No.
Well, Columbia was
the Coralco building?
Yeah. They wanted to do Spider-Man, right?
Oh, yes.
Pre-digital, cables running, the 8 arms. Forget it. I mean, just forget it. There are things that they couldn't do. And so we just didn't think about that. And of course, John, Phil, Rob Bottin, John, I know you're going to want to talk about him. He's really the reason that RoboCop is as good as it is on a production level, because he knew everybody. He knew Phil, he knew Rob, he knew and all of that state of the art of goo and the height of analog production, we just hit that wave.
Well, John Davison was legendary. He came out of the Roger Corman school. He was a publicist at Corman's. He became a producer. Then he produced The Howling for Joe Dante. Then he did, after RoboCop, he did Airplane, and it just a really brilliant guy, and he knew how to make a movie seem a lot bigger and have much more scope than the money that was available. Because,
well, and he was also a mentor to a lot of us, and he taught me one of the most valuable lessons anybody taught me. I was having some problems with Verhoeven on Starship Troopers and went to John for some advice and saying, this is what's going on, and that's what's going on. And I was being like whiny. And he looked at me and said, well, you're fucked. And it was like a light bulb went off in my mind and was like, of course you're right. I'm fucked. Very important thing to learn,
Yeah, yeah, he had a sense of humor about it all that really took the shine off of whatever problem you had.
Well, a very funny guy. And I think I said he produced The Howling for Joe Dante. He produced Piranha. Mike Fennell produced The Howling.
Yeah. Well, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, The Howling, you know, Rob's work, I think, is much better than American Werewolf. Much more terrifying film. Scared me almost out of the theater. Joe's work and Rob's work compared with that other silly film.
Yeah, you mean An American Werewolf with Rick, the Oscar won by Rick Baker. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Apologies to
now,
whoever.
The problem with RoboCop was nobody could take it seriously because of its title. John knew the script was great, and people wouldn't even read the script because the title felt cheap and cheesy, like a ripoff of Terminator or something.
Sure.
So you had trouble even getting directors to read it.
Or even the special effects people. You know, it was oh my God, who would ever want to make that?
Well,
you know, before opening the page, you know.
And Sheila Benson gave it a bad review in the LA Times, and Medavoy called the Times and said, get some other reviewer on that thing, you know, to take this down. It's interesting, though, Stephen King has a lot to say about the B movie and how it really, and you know, Stephen, Mick, that the B movie can go directly at criticism of the monoculture so much easier than, you know, Silkwood, Wall Street, whatever. You have to sort of handle the criticism in a gingerly way, where the B movie could just go right at it.
Yeah, it'll take your shit and shove it right back at you.
Right. I think also we caught this late 80s wave of that included Lethal Weapon and, you know, sort of action as a high art. But also with the 70s vigilante stories like Dirty Harry and
The Mechanic and things like that, yeah.
Death Wish, even Walking Tall, unfortunately. But they gave all those films gave the audience agency for a brief moment. And there is a theory, that not mine, that I steal and share with people about the adventure story, which skews male, and justice is achieved extrajudiciously. If you look at Bond, he's got to go around M, mother, to get the bad guy. Similarly to Dirty Harry and Death Wish, and RoboCop. Fulfills that, it gives the audience agency. And especially in the late 80s, when everything was being privatized, I've, you know, had audience members, I've seen it in their faces for like an hour and whatever. Suddenly that somebody's doing something about this big frigging mess. And I think that's an essential aspect of why we're here now and why it's longevity.
Well, it also mocks the law and order attitudes and platitudes that came out of the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration and all of that. And it's very
pushy. It's true. I mean, you know, going back to Foucault in Punishment and Discipline, he documents how there is a certain level of law for people who live on the street. And many times people were given a pass because of how hard it was to exist in the pre-revolutionary France and then during the empire. Now, you know, in certain places you spit, like Singapore, you're in prison for a while.
Yeah, or caned at the very least, yeah.
Yeah, so the what is law enforcement and what it should be are two different things. And I think everybody knows that in the back of their mind, especially when you take your driver's test.
Yeah. Well, RoboCop is one side of that coin. The other side of the coin of the oppressor and the oppressed is Mad God. Tell me a little bit about what was behind the motivation for making Mad God, the movie, Phil, that took you 30 years. Was it after you'd finish a job, you'd get back to work on Mad God and then take another job and then get back to work on it?
Well, after RoboCop 2, I've been thinking about this thing for a long, long time. And I wrote about 12 pages. It was kind of a poetic musing about what the feeling of the thing should be. And built a bunch of props and characters. And right after RoboCop 2, I shot about 6 minutes of material and then realized the scope of the project was just too big. And for some strange, unknown, mysterious reason, the idea just wouldn't let me go. And so I developed it exclusively, doing storyboards and ideas. And I would, if I was on location, I'd work on it. I'd work on it after work. I studied, Freud and Jung. And another one of the most valuable things that I learned about filmmaking was from Milos Forman. My wife was in the editorial department on Amadeus, and we'd go out to dinner, and I was asking him for advice as a young filmmaker, and again, he gave me some of the best advice, which was, if you want to take a good shit, you have to eat well. And it was like, that's kind of the license, the more time you have to work on something and develop it, it cooks or gets digested, in terms of his metaphor.
Good in, good out. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a period, after I shot the first 6 minutes or so, then there was a 20-year gap where I was just, eating well. And then I don't know really how it happened, but about 13 years ago or so, I was archiving it. And some of the guys in my studio, there were digital artists, grew up on the RoboCop, Star Wars documentaries, and that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to work with models and lights and cameras, but that ship had sailed. So they asked if they could do a shot, and I had some of the old puppets left over, and they did a shot, and they said, can we do another one? And I'd show them how to do the lighting and do a setup and whatnot. Then it just snowballed from there. More people went, oh, hey, do you need any help? And so I ended up getting like a relatively large crew to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And they all worked for free and for years. Wow.
And you could make a movie the way you want to make a movie when you
Well, there's no way I was going to pitch Mad God to a studio. So I just wanted to make this, very visceral kind of thing that was both repugnant and horrible and beautiful at the same time.
I mean, visually,
Neumeier has mentioned this film. Phil, is it? Can I watch it somewhere?
It's on Shudder.
Yeah.
Shutter.
Yeah.
And you can get a 1 month free pass there if you only want.
So everybody can watch Mad God for free.
Well, you know what? Though Shutter is a very well curated service. And particularly the horror films are of great interest, because Europeans can make horror films. We don't know how to make them anymore, really, but the European stuff is really creepy and ghostly and very well produced.
There's
some
great stuff.
I shot Alex Cox's advanced project at UCLA.
Did you know Alex is in Mad God?
That's what Neumeier mentioned.
Yeah.
Amazing.
He also well, I'll tell you later in an email. I think I have your email. I'll mention this other thing later. It's not
okay.
Public consumption.
Well, you talk about how the changing of the guard between stop motion, analog filmmaking, and digital filmmaking. It's interesting because digital filmmaking, they're both tools in telling a story. And people are always trying to pit physical, practical effects versus digital effects, when they can work hand in hand really well together, as you know better than anybody. But the first real digital effects movie with characters, dinosaurs, Jurassic Park, still works like gangbusters, despite it being 1993. The story carries it. These characters have weight. And there has certainly been improvement in detail, but still so many CG creations have no weight to them and they feel like you're watching a video game.
Yeah.
But tell me about that, because, you know, Guillermo had great success with Pinocchio doing it in traditional stop motion form. So there is still stop motion animation being created. But what do you feel about being in the middle of that, Phil?
You mean, the bridge between digital and
CG,
analog well, when the changeover happened, you know, I felt the Bombay doors had opened, you know, I was about to be Slim Pickens, and I got really depressed, and you know, I got pneumonia and had to go to bed for a couple of weeks, and you know, I thought I was done for, but you know, Stephen called up and he assured me, no, we need you. And you know, I overreacted emotionally to the whole, you know, thing. But
so this felt sudden to you with Jurassic Park suddenly?
Well, no,
everything
I'm friends
changed
with Dennis Muren, so I could kind of see it coming from young Sherlock to the Terminators. But I had no idea that they would be able to actually construct something that looked relatively lifelike. And so, but, you know, when, you know, Kathy Kennedy called us in, you know, Lanteri and, you know, Winston and Dennis and me, she, you know, I got hired because, you know, I knew paleontology and I knew all the dinosaurs and I knew the production process, you know, and so it was actually, in retrospect, you know, at that time, you know, kind of a no brainer, really. I didn't feel secure, but I was.
And you ended up embracing digital technology as well, because you kind of had to, and you could see the value of it as a tool.
We had no choice, but it did offer you abilities to do things that you could never do with stop motion. So, you know, that was interesting, but it was a vertical climb for all of us. You know, it was like the very first time in there, and the animators were all Canadian. They came from Chouinard because nobody taught computer graphics in the States, but they, you know, they were all of the Disney school, you know, of you know, squash and strategy or whatever you know cell animation was, or flying logos and, you know, that kind of thing. So they didn't really have any experience with doing things that had weight and mass and
character creation
and intention. Yeah.
So, Mike, when you're writing now, there are all these options that you're aware of. Do you realize when you're actually at the desk and at the keyboard that you can write anything and virtually anything can be made for the screen?
Yeah. And, you know, that's actually one of the things I think that people make a mistake about with RoboCop is that they call it science fiction, and it's really futurism.
Right. And not very far into the future.
No. And, you know, with Blade Runner and Road Warrior and RoboCop, with futurism, you can get there from here. Whereas science fiction, I mean, some of the later Lucas films, they're wearing togas. It could be 3,000 years in the past or 3,000 years in the future. So I think that's an important distinction. And when I was, I had written something called Animal about a researcher, an anti-vivisectionist, which is now in Guardians 3, who develops a chemical that transforms him. But compared to the X-Men and all going forward into the Marvel Universe, my creations were feeble. So in a way, it's limiting to me. The whole fantasy universe has, because I don't, that's not something that I write about. And I think the audience is becoming fatigued by those kind of portrayals as well. The sort of fake mythologies compared with Cupid and Psyche and some of the real Greek and Roman mythologies in Ovid, those are incredible. And they have a psyche.
And also, you know, with this, you know, back to back, like 90 minutes practically of computer graphic effects.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like drinking from the fire hose, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You're living in a video game.
Like the end of a Bruckner symphony where you just want it to be over with.
Very good. Very good analogy. Yeah. I mean, I frankly am not enthralled by this kind of, well, since we can do anything we want, let's do anything we want, which reflects in the larger culture in terms of genetic experimentation and AI. I think humans are a lot better at inventing than regulating what they invent. So just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And I think that's not just in entertainment. I mean, that's in the technological world at large. So circling back to my own work, you know, I'm more of a futurist.
Well, one of the things that made RoboCop so successful is that it's got a heart. It's got a very emotional core. You've got a human being who's gone through torturous agony and loss, and whose only hope to survive is to be partially rebuilt as a machine.
But it's true. And if you look at the Nolan's first Batman film, you know, the suit doesn't work. He crashes and burns. There's a gravity to RoboCop as well. It's not, we had four rules for RoboCop, all of which were violated in the sequels, which we weren't involved in. RoboCop can't be on the phone. He can't be on a bicycle. He can't kiss a girl, and he can't fly. And sure enough, they have him do all of those things.
Let's go back to the problem with getting people to take the script seriously before it was sold.
Right.
It went to various studios. John Davison was flogging it as an excellent producer would. But directors were passing on it. The title was its worst enemy and yet its biggest marketing hook. So tell me about the problems of getting a director and how it finally worked out with Paul Verhoeven, who would be a very unlikely choice despite doing such amazing stuff in Soldier of Orange and Spetters and, you know, amazing Dutch films.
Well, we had so many pieces of luck, including Phil's involvement, but it really did start with Fox and Columbia passing. And Davison walking it into Orion, where Barbara Boyle, his colleague from New World, had done the Madonna film and just was a real like production maniac. And Medavoy, being the gunslinger he is with Amadeus and Terminator and Silence of the Lambs, you know, he was like the United Artists model. Let's see what these guys can come up with. And there was very little supervision. So it ended up allowing all of us, the writers, the director, the producer, and Phil and all of his colleagues, to just like supply the best thing that they knew how to do. I had a theory African American and European directors did violence a lot better than their American counterparts. If you look at the Hughes brothers, Polanski, Verhoeven, Milos Forman, their portrayal of violence was that it's quick, it's bloody, and there are consequences, compared with someone like Tarantino and his colleagues, where somebody's head gets blown off in the back of a car. Now, oh, the big joke is, hey, how do we clean this thing up? That treatment of violence was, you know, I suggested, let's look at Verhoeven. Soldier of Orange is very mean, but also has laughs in it. The violence is followed by absurd humor, which is
The Fourth Man is another one that has really conflicting points of view. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's an interesting tone. I mean, it's melodrama, but the good kind of melodrama where the volume is about 10% louder than it should be. And Paul's very good at that. You know, he's good at hysteria. He's good at a radical portrayal of fear. He's just not afraid of those things. So we got so lucky with Paul.
Hey, the story that John mentioned to me, and I don't know, I always kind of took it as like urban mythology, but all these directors were passing on it. You know, it was like starting with the A-list directors and going down to the C-list directors. And he said that he was going through the director's, dictionary or whatever, and he got down to V. That was the last letter that he looked at, and he saw Verhoeven. And I seriously doubt that's true, but that's what he said.
Help me, Obi-Wan Verhoeven. You're our last hope. Yeah. So when you were in the construction phase of the models, Phil, tell me how that came about. You were making miniatures. How big were the miniatures?
Well, 209 was about a foot tall.
Yeah.
Which was a comfortable size, that Ray always characterized his puppets as like being about the size of a small cat, something that you could get your hands on and actually move around. And I am not very good at doing, mechanically oriented designs. I've got really no sense of hard surface designs.
So you're more about creatures that live.
Yeah, organic stuff. And so I was really lucky when I was on, I think it was Howard the Duck. We go over to this guy's barbecue and at ILM, while we were working at ILM, and I ran into this kid. I mean, he wasn't more than like 18 or 19 years old. Yeah, no formal training at all, self-taught. And he brought in a couple of model parts that he'd made. And it was like, I just kind of found this Mozart of a guy that knew materials and could visualize, the thing and knew how to put this together. I mean, the RoboCop 2 model was incredibly complicated, unbelievably complicated. And I think Craig was somewhere out there on the,
This is Craig who?
Craig Hayes. He Craig designed Hayes. The 209.
Right. Right.
And somewhere out there on the scale, where he was just able to embrace all of this stuff and see it as a whole, and then kind of knew how to get there. So I was really, we all were really lucky that Craig was there to design that thing.
How did you get that first Star Wars job with the chess characters?
George didn't get everything that he wanted in England with Stuart Freeborn's material. I think Stuart got phlebitis or something, so he was compromised. And they didn't have hardly any money. So I think that it kind of, like, you can see it, it looked like they had to raid the costume department for like Beatrix Potter, things. And so George talked Fox out of some money to do a bunch of inserts and hired Rick Baker to supervise a bunch of stop motion animators. There were about four of us. And we did the, a bunch of masks. And George's direction was like, build as many space aliens as you possibly can in 6 weeks.
Right.
And so while we were working on that, he would come by every week and check out what we were doing. And he saw a stop motion puppet that I had made, when I was much younger. And around that time, Crichton had come out with, Westworld, but it was one of those things. Anyway, and he had this hologram scene with these knights, And they were just guys on a, you know, big checkerboard. And they were supposed to be small. And it was like, oh God, you know, my movie's going to look similar. And then he saw the stop motion puppet. He goes, hey, can you guys do that? And it was like, yeah. He said, well, can you make me, you know, as many stop motion puppets as you can in 2 weeks? It's right at the end of the schedule. And,
no problem, George.
Yeah. So that started that ball rolling.
Yeah.
Have you seen any cuts or outtakes from Star Wars by that point?
No. We were invited to George screened the cantina scene and the chess scene for us. And so, but we were in pig heaven. You know, we had just been working on television commercials all the time, which was graduate school because the turnover was so fast. You got to learn, you know, a lot about how this stuff went together. And we had a great mentor at Cascade Pictures of California, Phil Kellison, who was this really sweet guy and would let us work after hours on our own projects. And I forgot where I was going with that anyway.
So just one little clawback. Rockwood Geoffrey and Hoyt Yateman did a matte painting and a rear projection for me on my advanced project at UCLA. And Hoyt talked a lot about Dave Allen.
Yeah.
One of the greats. I mean, the spirit of Ray Harryhausen was captured by so many of his fans and acolytes, you among them, that kept the stop motion game going and even improving on it, which was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, we're lucky. In the right place at the right time, you know. I mean, there weren't that many people doing it.
Yeah.
And I never worried about, I was always a gig worker, and that worked out really well for me because you could work, you know, for 2 weeks and get, like, you know, earn enough money because everything was really cheap back then, and have like 3 weeks off or 1 month on and 2 months off. And like, so it allowed you to, you know, earn money and take time to work on your own projects. So that was, you know, that was really, really quite convenient. And, you know, I just waited for the telephone to ring.
Yeah, it was really a small world. Rocco was being mentored by Matt Yurasich, and, you know, who else besides Matt was doing that kind of brilliant work?
Yeah,
mentoring was very important. And, you know, younger guys today don't really have the same access that we did, you know, back in the day. You know, I mean, I was working on this independent project of one of his stories, Sound of Thunder, and he was speaking at a local community college, and I went there with the script that Bill Stromberg had written, and I built a stop motion dinosaur, and I showed him some stuff, I gave him a contact, and he wrote back and he said, you know, if you make any money off of this, I'm going to sue you. And but that started a conversation that went on for years and years and years. You know, I had all these letters from him, and I don't know what the fuck happened to him. And so Ray, you know, back in the day in the late 60s, his philosophy was love, love, love. You know, like John Lennon, you have to do what you love, because if you do that and fail, you'll be in a far better position than if you don't try and never knew. And right. The nomenclature changes over the years from love, love, love to follow your bliss, and then to follow your passion. And so I looked up passion in the dictionary, and it comes from the Latin patai, which means to suffer.
Mick, you know, I've got to say, you're describing Mick your attitude and approach as well, because you're just, you know, talking to everybody, and your own work is very prolific, and I don't see a lot of people. I don't think you have you're in too many people's black book.
Well, here's hoping, or they keep it a secret, but But, you know, it's the Dick Smith philosophy, you know, the great, the father of modern makeup effects. He was so open with all of his ideas. All these young guys, Tom Savini and Rick Baker and all, would call Dick Smith, how do you do this? And he was so generous because he was a trailblazer. It was the same sort of thing as it seems Ray Harryhausen was. Talking about love, 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 I hear that that was not the philosophy of the set of RoboCop, that there was a lot of stress and a lot of discomfort on the RoboCop set. Now, often that makes for good movies, but not always. In this case, it did. Michael, tell me, what was it like to enter the war zone of RoboCop?
Well, Ed was on the set more than I was. I was scheduled to do the second unit, and I looked at Ed and Paul and went, that person is going to get creamed. So I went away and did a low-budget feature directed, wrote and directed for Charlie Band, which was its own circus of fun.
Yes, but Charlie's been on the show as well.
But I kept getting messages from Ed, and then I was there for 3 weeks. But I didn't catch the shit show at the beginning with the suit and all of that. I just heard that from Ed, but I did manage to show up for the gas station explosion, because I had a scene specifically. Ed Davison had done all this work to get Shell Motor Company, because I put in two other scripts. Shell gas, the explosion pops off the S, so you get hell and flames. And Paul had shot that, and I went, oh shit, man, I finally got it into a film. And then Paul cut it out.
Nah.
Yeah.
You can see it for about 16 frames, I think.
Yeah, exactly. If you blink, maybe he didn't understand the joke. I mean, that's a quibble compared to, I don't have any other criticisms.
Well, I know that the actual construction of the costume for Peter Weller was very complex. And I know Rob Bottin, and I know he did The Thing, and he did The Howling before that. And he also works on a clock painted by Dolly.
right. That's why Davison, and he have had so many fallings out and then reconciliations, because, I mean, if you look at the new RoboDoc, Ed and John and Paul and I had ideas, but basically Rob, along with this, his assistant, really perfected the shape and the look of RoboCop.
Right. You know, and the choreographer who helped Peter Weller do his work actually helped to streamline the costume. It's very well illustrated in the documentary, which is
the movie couldn't have been made without him.
Yeah. Yanni. Well,
he had to clear all of the joints in the costume so that there were elbows and there were shoulders and there were knees and there were hips.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he was so restricted, he couldn't act, but couldn't move.
Well, and how he built the pantomime too was, really the mark of a pro. You know, Robo moves from his chest and then he moves his head. And it's like a bunk, 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 bunk. I mean, it's beautifully, choreographed pantomime.
Well, it's so well thought out. The brain was put in the chest, and so the chest leads. Yeah.
Yeah. And without Peter having that relationship ahead of time and trusting this guy, then it got to this crisis point and he came back in and settled Peter down. I mean, we had like 10 lucky things happen for it to become what it was. I remember when I had this fantasy about what's his name, George Cosmatos, who came in to meet about RoboCop. No disrespect intended, but you can imagine RoboCop arriving at the precinct. He would kick open the door, and this guy in a wetsuit including the flippers, would flop in with a little snorkel, right? And he'd say,
gurgle, gurgle.
With sparkles on it, right? Glitter. Hey, you know, and speaking of Paul being difficult, you know, when we were finished shooting the boardroom scene, you know, I went up to him and said, hey, can I have a minute with you? And he was standing by the OCP city without a blood splatter, and he put both of his hands down on it and he bowed his head and he said, I suppose you're going to tell me I'm fucked. I'm fucked up, you know, like everybody else. And I went like, no, I was just going to tell you, I'm done here for a while. And, you know, I'm going to go back and work with my guys and, you know, get ready for the boardroom scene. And I was like, okay. And that was some of the stuff with Ed too, going into it, because Paul didn't know anything about visual effects at that time, and how are we going to create the Ed 209 stuff? And so I proposed that that we build two Ed 209s. One would be full scale, and the other for, you know, live action shots, because I didn't want to do blue screen backgrounds of Ronnie Cox giving his spiel, and because that stuff looks terrible. So we needed an actual physical prop in the set for those, you know, heavy duty dialogue scenes. And then the ambulatory stuff was all done with stop motion. And but then you've got this big prop sitting on the on the set, and that's just not enough. So I proposed that once he comes in and shuts down, you keep him alive with this bass pedal note. There's just this hum, this kind of unsettling quasi subwoofer noise that's going on that keeps him present, you know, as an entity and not just as a sculpture. And Paul would always go for that. You know, he would always go for, you know, an idea.
Was that humming noise, was that Steve Flick who came up with that?
Yep.
Wow.
So, Michael, what's your fondest memory, before we close out here, what's your fondest memory of RoboCop? I mean, it led to sequels, it led to a TV series, but your personal experience with this movie?
Well, again, it's got to be the process of writing a script. We, Ed and I would, once Orion optioned and we got into the second, third, fourth, and fifth draft, we worked at the Tara building over that since was turned down, over the Culver Studios. And
Tara from Gone with the Wind, yeah.
And pacing, typing, pacing. You know, for example, the topper line at the end of the film, we'd sort of bankrupt ourselves completely and we were fucked. And here's Clarence Boddicker hovering over the RoboCop covered in debris. And Ed said, we've got to have a line here. We've got to have the line all day, all day, all day. What about this? What about that? And Ed said, no, it's not good enough. I wanted to strangle him. And finally, I just blurted out, sayonara, RoboCop. Boing. And he said, that's it. And so those kinds of things, it was heavy lifting, every line. I think that's why the script is so tight, because we pretty much legislated everything, which is what, as you know, the Milos Forman thing and your Mad God creation, I've been working on a streaming series about artificial intelligence, and it's taken 8 years to get it to this point, you know, embarrassingly more like 10, but that's why it's good, you know, and instant gratification is now seems to be the rule of the day, and it just, I don't think it'll ever happen.
You know, when I sent Paul some DVDs of Mad God, and then when it was finished, he wanted to see the completed thing because he wanted to go through it one frame at a time. And he said, you know, when I make my Jesus film, I want you to do the part when Jesus meets Satan.
Good one.
That's a compliment. Yeah.
So it was writing the script. It was writing the script. That was really a real, real great, great ride.
How about for you, Phil? What is your most memorable moment of working on RoboCop?
It was working with Frank Curiosity. And we would shoot the background plates, and I'd go up and work with Frank. He had an 8-perf of VistaVision background, because that's how I, one of the widest format camera to get the most, negative to, or print.
The greatest detail with the least grain, yeah.
Yeah, and boy, he was not happy with me at all, because it was all new to him. And he said, how can I cut this together? How long do I know what the timing is for this? It's just like empty shots, and there's no robot or anything in it, for most of the stuff. I mean, we did use the big Ed 209 for lighting references for just about everything, but how am I supposed to know how long this thing is supposed to go on? And I just, follow the action that's there. And he said, what if there's no action in the background? It was like, well, just allow 4 or 6 seconds. I mean, I don't know, most of the shots are around, between, around 4 seconds, in an action movie. So just, do it like that. And he was like kind of grumpy about it. But then it turned out, he turned out to be my savior on the thing. And I think John had a lot to do with this, was as I started generating the shots, they wouldn't show it to Paul because they knew it would fry his brain, and that he would feel compelled to direct stuff that he had no idea, how to direct, and worrying about details. And so Frank and John wouldn't let him see anything until a sequence was cut. And then he'd look at it and go like, oh, yeah. And there were no retakes or anything. There were no adjustments. I mean,
Phil, I don't want to cut you off, but the integration of the close-ups when Ed walks into the boardroom with the big model really give it the weight and substance when the foot lifts off and the driver bolts turn, you really get a sense of the weight of the thing. It's really storyboarded so beautifully.
Yeah, well, that's all Paul, really doing that. There's one shot, God, I'm going to mess up on the guy's name. He's a famous photographer that would do still lifes with like human heads or...
Joel Peter Witkin.
Joel Peter Witkin.
Yeah.
And so, one of the shots when Ed 209's foot comes down made a miniature set of the OCP boardroom. And essentially all it is a gray carpet and a wall. And so I got a picture of a Witkin print, and it was of this guy laying on this table with a rope tied around his dick that went up to a pulley and had like a 10-pound weight on it or something like that. And so I made like a little frame, and that's what the picture is on the wall in the background, for that foot coming down shot. And, it's there,
Now nice that sounds like a great time to wrap up on that image. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It was great to bring a little reunion together here at the last minute.
Yeah.
Mick, thank you very much. I haven't been able to spend that much time with Phil, and obviously he's a kindred spirit. I really appreciate your giving us the time. Thank you, Mick.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Everybody should check out the documentary on Streambox and on streaming wherever you can find it. And, happy RoboCop.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you, guys.
Phil, I'll email you a little bit later.
All right. Take care. Thanks, guys. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.